Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Hey, Thriving Farmers, it's Michael Kilpatrick here, and I have an amazing guest today to share with you. Nicole Masters is an independent agroecologist, storyteller, systems thinker, and educator. She is recognized as a knowledgeable and dynamic speaker on the topic of soil health. Her team of soil coaches at Integrity Soils work alongside producers in the U.S., Canada, and across, I guess that's Australasia.
Australasia.
Okay, there we go.
New word for you. Yeah, so that's Australia and New Zealand.
Oh, is that how you combine the two? All right, very cool. All right, so she supports producers who work on over 1.1 million acres to take their operations to the next level in nutrient density, profitability, and environmental outcomes. Her book titled For the Love of Soil showcases examples of the tools and principles producers are using to regenerate the soils, describing a step-by-step triage of actions so that you too can regenerate your land. Her website is integritysoils.co.nz. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's great.
Yeah, I just got done reading your book about a week or 10 days ago. And I want to tell you, it was one of the, every soil book I read, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the best. But Seriously, I love yours because not only do you talk about some really new and innovative things, and I learned so much from it, but you also share some great stories. And I think that's what really brings out that I loved about the book is it just shared these exact case studies of how you did different things on farms, which was really good.
Yeah. And I think as people, we all learn better through stories. And that was part of the drive for the book was, let's tell the stories of people that are really doing some extraordinary stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. So how did you get obsessed with soil?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I don't even remember how I fell into it at university, but I ended up doing some soil science papers and just thinking, this is really, really fascinating and got really excited by it. And that's what I ended up majoring in. But actually, it wasn't until 2002 when I saw Elaine Ingham speak and she talked about soils being alive. And just for me, the light bulbs went on because I'd found soil really exciting before I realized it was alive. And I guess when it comes down to it, everything that we are concerned about comes back to soil. If that's greenhouse gases in the atmosphere or human nutrition or water quality or land management, it all comes back to soil. So for me, it's something that I've never got tired of, and there's always something new to learn.
Absolutely. And then what year did you actually start to take it to the business level?
Well, in 1999, I was managing community gardens, and that was just kind of something I'd fallen into finishing university and just did some work. And then I moved back to my father's farm in 2000 and started to do large-scale composting and vermiculture, so worm composting. And I taught my first class in 2003 to a bunch of avocado growers about mycorrhizae and the role of fungi, and realized about then that actually there was a whole world to be explored. So, selling vermicast and compost there wasn't a lot of people doing or even selling worms. So I got some work doing household waste reductions and selling worms to those programs. So yeah, I started, I think, in my own business in 2002. So my son at the time was one and I just couldn't find work as a single parent at the time. And the soil thing just kind of kept evolving.
So first, let's kind of lay the groundwork and talk about the problem we find ourselves in as a world. You mentioned that some of the fertilizers we used in the 50s are just now finding their way into the water streams and the waterways.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that and just the, where are we today, 2020, we're recording this.
Yeah. It's very fascinating. It's like we've been on this 100-year chemical experiment and people are really waking up to, well, what is that impact of that chemical in my body or in the environment or in my children or my children's children? And there's a lot more work coming out around epigenetics mm-hmm. and the impact of, say, you know, drinking water out of plastic bottles with that are releasing PBAs and all sorts mm-hmm. of things is changing your child's, like, so every generation of children or male children are being born with half the sperm rate of their fathers.
Oh, wow.
Which is, you know, those kind of terrifying statistics. And mm-hmm. and certainly as I started to delve into and do more research on the book and thinking about what are we doing with food, for instance, how are we changing the epigenetic profile of our own children and our children's children through this chemical experiment. And a lot of the results now are coming to the forefront. Why are we dealing uh-huh. with so many human health issues and, you know, learning difficulties and all sorts of things that society's facing. And it's like the risk assessment isn't possible to do on all the different chemicals that, I mean, there's a new chemical invented every 3 seconds. There's another chemical that's just mm-hmm. being out on the market, and we don't know what these things do. And if we think about nitrogen fertilizers that were applied in the 50s, like you were saying, you mm-hmm. know, they're now coming out into the waterways now, causing algal blooms and eutrophication. And it's like those things become very hard to scramble back from. And mm-hmm. and so for me, a big emphasis is thinking about what are the unintended consequences of many of the actions that we're doing on land, and how can we really start to align with nature so we don't get these unintended consequences and we're not dealing with a situation with your great-grandkids, for instance. So it's something that mm-hmm. I'm quite passionate about, and it's like a lot of what we are told that we have to use in agriculture is actually a fallacy. You know, we mm-hmm. don't need to be putting all these chemicals on. We don't need to be using all the fertilizers. And that's certainly the case for the people I talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing you mentioned, I think I bring it up later, but you talk about the phosphorus is just super high levels of phosphorus can be contributed to higher rates of cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that phosphorus does in the body is it causes cell replication. And so the work hasn't been done in New Zealand. There's certainly research papers that look if you feed rats on a high phosphorus diet that they end up developing lung and skin cancers. Uh-huh. And New Zealand has the highest cancer rate in the world, which, you know, people might hear that and be quite shocked. And even uh-huh. if you take melanoma out, so skin cancers, because New Zealand doesn't have an ozone layer down there, we're still number three. So wow. New Zealand has this really, really high level of cancers. And we also have the highest level of phosphorus in our food of any place in the world, except Singapore. So New Zealand uses more phosphorus per acre of land than anywhere else. And there's a consequence to that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And why do they use so much? Is it just because what they've been told?
It's because of what they were told, and certainly in the 1950s and 60s, there was a government program to break in that land. So New Zealand is the youngest agricultural country mm-hmm. too. And so when they arrived, New Zealand was never a grassland. We never had mammals, for instance. So we only had two bats. So the rest of the wildlife were birds. And so to break that land in as such, to turn it into agricultural grazing land, there was a lot of scrub and forest, and that all needed to be removed. And then you've got a soil situation that's very different from mm-hmm. what it is that a grass requires. So how they got that grass to grow was they poured phosphorus on, and the government actually subsidized that to happen. And so what New Zealanders have been left with is to grow grass, you have to put phosphorus on. But we're talking about a totally different microbial population and a totally different soil carbon profile. Like New Zealand soils were very different from, mm-hmm. say, American soils. Mm-hmm. Maybe actually, they're probably more like Vermont soils.
If you okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with those. Yes. from up yeah. there. You know, a lot of farmers want to be told the answer. And I know you talk about there being just not one answer because everything's so different.
Yeah. And everything's so complex. And I think it's what, one, we've been trained to do from very young, is to look for the answer and for things to be really simple. And if we're looking for that kind of fix, then we're going to get given the answer, which is going to be, you're going to have to put on this type of fertilizer and these types of pesticides and now this type of fungicide, instead of really looking at what is unique about your land? What is unique about yourself? And so every case has nuances because people are different, and yeah, soil situations are different and climate is different and the animals you want to run might be different or the stocking rates or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, it's almost this tendency to want to seek the answer instead of realizing actually the answer is observe, take note, be with your land, really think about how things operate differently through the season. I mean, there's so much complexity to agriculture, which is what makes it really exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the problems that we've got into in agriculture is because we were seeking the answer.
So how would you classify soil health? Because I think that's very ubiquitous too.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. For me, soil health is a soil that's vibrantly alive, that can support, you know, biodiversity below and above ground, that has clean water, that is a net sink for greenhouse gases, that really is something that supports life. It is the life support system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, looking for, you know, for me in a lot of landscapes, do we have that beautiful aggregate crumb structure? Are we building, you know, more soil carbon or water holding capacity, all of that kind of picture? And even, you know, I work a lot in some of these semi-arid, even high desert environments. And it's, you know, what does soil health look like there compared to what does soil health look like in New Zealand? So visually that can look very, very different.
Yeah.
But it's in this ecosystem, is it functioning to its full potential?
Later in the book, you talk a lot about the plant health pest connection. Can you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, everything for me is an indicator. So what is happening with weeds, what is happening with pests, and they're not just a given. They are actually there to indicate something to you about animal, plant health in this case, or soil health. And so insects won't just attack every single plant. They are seeking plants that have specific disruptions. So disruptions in terms of not being able to form what we call these complex proteins or complex amino acids. So you end up with free amino acids in the plant because the plant is dysfunctional for some reason. You know, the microbiology maybe not working as well as it could, but basically it changes how those nitrogen forms are complexed in the plant, and it sends a signal to insects to come and clean it up. And so we're seeing the rise of broad scale pest attacks, like what was happening in South Africa over this winter, where you see absolute plagues of locusts coming in because those ecosystems are disrupted, because there's something, those plants are under stress and they're like, cool, all right, we'll come and clean that up for you. So they're there to provide a really important role, but people, you know, there's this tendency to reach for a pesticide instead of looking at, okay, what plants maybe are they attacking? And is it the whole field, or is it just the, is it just this edge, or is it just, you know, here, or what happened here? And getting really curious about where you see the patterns of insect attack, so that we can really move away from the pesticides, because they certainly are ones that are causing a lot of problems in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I know, like when we do broadacre squash production, the winter squash production, they always talk about putting the Hubbard squashes on the edge because for some reason the insects like to attack them more than they do their other squash. And so that always comes back to me is like, say, is the Hubbard squash not as just genetically as healthy of a plant? Yeah, that always has been fascinating to me.
Yeah. And, you know, often we grow plants where they might be slightly out of season, or it's in conditions where maybe it's too hot or too cold. And and we are climatically stressing those plants and expecting them, oh, you know, I want to be able to grow broccoli in the middle of summer. And it's like, well, you know, good luck.
Yes.
It's but
not
yeah.
quite meant to be done.
Not quite. But yeah, we want to be able to do everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing you talk about, and you mentioned in the story about River Sun, is the repeated asking of why. Yeah, dive into that.
Yeah. So River Sun Nurseries, I absolutely love working with them. They are New Zealand's largest rootstock nursery. They do up to 5 million rootstock a year for viticulture. They're also doing kiwi fruit and avocados. And one of the practices that they were doing was they would lay, so they'd make furrows in the soil to, mm-hmm. to plant the rootstock into, and then they would cover it with a black plastic. And that black plastic was to, you know, suppress weeds. Then they would have to run irrigation tape underneath that plastic, because now they need to get water in there, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then that's nice and warm and it heats the soil up quickly, which is great. But then it gets too hot, so then they have to paint it. And then at the end of the season, they've got all this massive plastic waste and the irrigation tape waste that they need to dispose of. And so when I arrived there, we went through this process of why, you know, why, mm-hmm. why are you doing this? Well, we need to make the soil warm. We need to suppress weeds. Well, we need to, you know, make sure we've got irrigation. And so we took those steps back and went, okay, well, what would it look like if we use something else to suppress weeds? So in that case, they rolled out small barley bales, mm-hmm. like barley mm-hmm. straw bales, and used that for weed suppression. And then found, well, you don't need the tape anymore. And so they costed the whole thing out. They looked at labor. They looked at time. They looked at all the different inputs and the costs of everything, and then disposal, and went, well, it saves them an absolute fortune by actually rolling out a barley straw, which is then contributing to soil health and providing mm-hmm. a mulch and all the rest of it. So dollar for dollar, it made much more sense to do something that was much more eco-friendly. But they just got into that zone of, this is what we do, and we've mm-hmm. always done it this way, and this is how this is done, you know, across the world, mm-hmm. instead of asking those questions for themselves. So it was a lot of fun, and they are an enterprise that really does ask those why questions. So mm-hmm. I recommend you ask that why question at least 6 times, you know, really get to the bottom of it. And if it comes back to, well, that's what granddad did, mm-hmm. then you need to rethink what that practice was that you've just been doing, because it actually, it has the potential to save a lot of money and maybe transform what your operation is doing. Now, I got an update from Riversun, and I hear now they're actually moving into a geotextile fiber. So mm-hmm. they're continuing to ask the question, but looking at something that might be easier for them to manage than the barley straw.
Yeah, we actually were doing small square bales for a straw, and we switched to the big round ones. And so we bought a English bale chopper. And so that went in the back 3-point. We just would blow it out over the fields.
Yes.
And that worked out quite well. And it always, you know, we always ran those numbers of, okay, it's how many hours on the tractor to blow this out. But then you do on the other side of how many hours of weeding are you saving? Mm-hmm. You know, the soil, I mean, just the soil after our squash crops was just such a beautiful soil because of all that organic matter being inputted.
Yeah.
And so if you, and just, so the overall costing out meant you were saving vast amounts of money.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's something that most people don't do enough of, or don't consider all of that. Like, what's your labor? What's the fuel? You know, all of the whole picture. So you can mm-hmm. sit back and go, well, actually it's costing me. There's so many aspects on people's operations that it's costing them money, and they're propping it up with other parts of the business without going, oh, actually,
yeah,
this needs to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that not looking at the holistic business, just looking at a very specific part, not seeing the interconnecting points.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned enabling factors too when you talk about Steve in chapter 3. Do you want to unpack what you mean by enabling factors?
So enabling factors, or on the flip side, could also be seen as limiting factors. So what are the aspects, where is the triage or the critical factors that are going to enable plants to grow optimally or stop them growing? So mm-hmm. we look at, well, what is the first most important enabling factor? Well, number one, it's the sun. Mm-hmm. You know, if the sun goes out, obviously we're in a whole lot of trouble, but the sun. And then the next thing is, well, what else would be critical? If it stopped, nothing else would work, and that would be air. Mm-hmm. So it's the same in the soil as it is in our body. And so then the next thing would be water. So thinking about those enabling factors in terms of what is it that really slows optimal production, growth and health in an ecosystem, and then using that to determine where do we take action. And what I found is on most operations globally, air is not moving into the system. People have major problems with compaction mm-hmm. through what they've been doing historically with management. Yeah.
Interesting. You know, something that just popped in my head, if you could pick, would you rather have unlimited clean water, or would you rather have like a, not, I don't want to say you can't have a perfect soil, but like a really, really high quality, maybe like sandy loam soil to work with?
Compared to clean water?
Yeah. So let's say you had like maybe a really challenging, stony, more clayish soil, or versus compared to a really nice soil versus unlimited water.
Well, that's a tricky one. I guess it would depend what environment I was in.
And probably what you're growing, I guess, too.
What, and probably what I'm growing. Yeah, really tricky. And someone recently kind of flipped my perception of water on my head a little bit by stating that all you need is 6 inches of water. Like, you can grow anything on 6 inches of water. And I was like, wow, okay. And, you know, and seeing what he's achieving and going, okay, all right, well, maybe that could be a truth.
Okay, so when you say 6 inches of water, is that because if you have the soil done, if you have your soil managed well, it will just hold all that water for you?
That's right. Uh-huh. Yes. So what's happening on most people's properties is because air isn't moving, then water isn't moving in either. And so people think, oh, you know, we've just had an inch of rain. And it's like, no, you didn't. You maybe got like 1 millimeter maybe has gone in and the rest has evaporated. So we've created these soils across the planet that go from flash flood to drought, flash flood to drought, because they're compacted. And so water is actually not the limiting factor that we think it is in a lot of environments. It's soil not having that air space and the porosity to draw water in. I guess, you know, you can turn a lot of soils around, and, you know, water is certainly going to help speed it up. So that's a very tricky question. I don't know if I'd have a really clear answer on that. I need to totally see the whole picture. Yeah.
It's more one of those, what would you do?
I don't know. Yeah. But I mean, I don't necessarily feel like I think we irrigate a lot of places we don't necessarily need to irrigate, and we're wasting a lot of water. Certainly having a soil that's functional.
Now, you also talk about the 6 different livestock classes in a soil. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard someone like break it down like you had. Talk to us why that matters.
I think it's important to understand your underground livestock like it is to understand your above ground livestock. And I met this guy once and he was like, you got livestock, you got dead stock. And it's always kind of stuck with me in terms of, you know, we really need to understand what that underground livestock is and how they require, you know, different management techniques and require different feeding or different watering, just like, you know, a cow or a horse would. So understanding, you know, I mean, I could talk about understanding viruses, but I think we actually have very, very, very little understanding of viruses, even though they are the most common organism on the planet, the most common organism in soil. I mean, right now, obviously, we're all panicking about COVID, and we understand so little about viruses. But anyway, so also, but one thing we do know is if you take out all the other predation in the soil ecosystem, viruses is the number one cause of death for bacteria. So they control the bacterial life cycle. Otherwise, bacteria would live forever. Like, they just wouldn't die.
Okay.
So it's viruses that kind of keep that population down. So they're very important in terms of nutrient and water cycling, is that death and decay of bacteria. And then it's
talk about some. You say in China that, you know, organic soils have 4 to 5 fold increase in the viruses.
Yeah. So where we see soils that are very functional and very healthy, there's a huge amount of virus in there. You know, and the research that's coming out in terms of horizontal gene transfer and evolution and cell genetics is viruses have a very important role in gene expression and a very important role in making us who we are. You know, part of evolutionary theory potentially is that viruses had a big role in this and have basically, you know, learned to farm us, I guess, in some ways. So and I'd like to understand more about viruses, and you get into the research and everyone's like, there's so much more work that needs to be done. We don't understand. Anyway, so it's quite fun. And that's the fun stuff about soil, is there's so much of it is like, oh, we still don't really understand. We're just scratching on the surface.
And then you've got the bacteria, and that's the next level.
Yeah. So, you know, incredibly important in terms of decomposition. I mean, if we didn't have bacteria, I mean, the whole planet would just become pretty overwhelmed. And, you know, in our own bodies, we have, you know, 3 pounds of bacteria in our gut system, and how important they are for, you know, hormones and well-being. I mean, they've just developed a vaccine that's made of a soil bacteria for PTSD for human health, right?
Oh, wow.
Which is really cool. And so they're looking at giving it to first responders, you know, ambulance in the military to actually help people deal with trauma. But there's, you know, different types of bacteria that are forming really important roles in soil. You know, they're what helps to form rain clouds. What forms frost is actually types of bacteria, is what, you know, the plant is intimately communicating with all the time, about nutrients, about water, about hormones, all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, bacteria, you know, they're the, you know, the smallest single-celled organisms on the planet. And then the next ones up are your fungi. And then I get into, you know, your protozoa and our micro arthropods, the insects, and talk about all these, the different livestock and soil, basically, and why they're so important.
Well, and the thing is, when you're managing your soil well, you're letting those all work in harmony with each other. And that is only helping your soil work better.
That's right. And then your soil is working for you instead of you working for it. So how do we support the optimal livestock so that we can step back and enable the plant to be communicating with the microbiology, and the microbiology be communicating with the plant, and just get out of the way? I mean, a lot of the issues we're dealing with, just because humans keep fiddling, you know, if we just supported that soil ecosystem, you know.
Yeah. Get out of the way. Because you talk about how a lot of the sugars that a plant takes in is actually going to feed the soil.
Yeah, so plants are photosynthesizing, collecting that sugar, and then exuding different types of exudates. So there'll be, you know, fatty acids, amino acids, different types of hormones, as well as those sugars. So they're sending out just this, you know, this gorgeous myriad of foods, basically, to signal to different types of microbes, basically farming that system to say, hey, I need this, I need that, I'm under stress, can you provide this? And yeah, so that the plant really is pumping that system all the time.
Now, some people say that, like, when you have your soil, all you need to do is just kind of let the soil be healthy, and your healthy soil will provide all the nutrients. But then on the other hand, I hear people say, well, that's great, but you've got to get your soil into that good condition first. What do you believe?
Yeah. So when I first heard that message, we pulled our whole fertilizer program, which had been happening on the farm, and went into compost teas, and production crashed. We had massive animal health problems. We lost some very expensive livestock, and the light kind of went on for me, like, it's not all what you need is biology. I mean, and this is where I talk about the five M's. So what is it that you've really got to look at? So the five M's are your minerals, your microbes, your management, your organic matter, or your mindset. And looking at those five different aspects and going, well, which one is it that's causing the drag in the system? Because on some properties, all you need is biology. On another property, all you might need is minerals, or you might need a trace element to kickstart that biology, and off you go. Or you've got those two things working, but your management is terrible. That's where you need to look. And so I'm not in any of those one camps. I think every situation is different. And it's easy for people to build those assumptions if they're not traveling a lot and seeing, well, actually that is only a truth in this ecotype, because there are some environments where that is true. That is so true. Yeah.
Well, some of those soils have all those nutrients locked up in them and they just need released. But then there's other soils which are very deficient in certain things.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes all it is a bit of trace element for that microbial system to get functional, and then they can mine and release a lot of phosphate. Like, you'll find there's very few environments in the world where phosphate is absolutely nil and zero. Uh-huh. And what we're seeing is, even in some of the places that are, you know, world famous for not having any phosphate, so say the Cape of South Africa or Western Australia, which you know, is not meant to have any phosphate, we are seeing farmers there operating and farming very well without any phosphate issues, without using any phosphate. Uh-huh. and have been doing that for a long time, so just using biology. So it's always to look at, well, what is the situation here? And what I see a lot of is people are missing key trace elements, particularly boron. Mm-hmm. Seem to find a lot of that. And boron's role in the plant is to translocate and move sugars around. So if it's not functional, then it's not going to be working with the plant in terms of helping it pump mm-hmm. sugars out to the biology, and then nothing works, because it's the plant communicating with the microbes that builds mm-hmm. soil and does all of that. So if we don't have that trace element, nothing's going to go that well. And mm-hmm. I've been on operations that are doing a great job and are not building soil because they didn't have any boron.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually something my soil test showed I'm deficient in. So I will. Yeah. I'm going to get right on that.
Yeah. And a good source for boron is actually chicken manure, if you can get.
Okay.
Yeah. For some reason, chickens eat stuff and then poop boron. They're like these alchemists.
Okay.
Who knows do what they do.
I have access to that. So I guess I'm good to go.
Yeah.
Let's talk about fulvic and humic acid. I know mm-hmm. that's something that, and again, I feel like I've been reading soil books for years, but mm-hmm. I just was introduced to those two things really like a year or 2 years ago. And so mm-hmm. I feel like a baby in all of this sometimes, but talk to me about the roles there and why those are so important.
Yeah. So why I quite like them is that they're easy to use. They are a waste product, so they come from soft brown coals. So they're not necessarily being mined for these humic type products. You can also make a fulvic or a humic acid off vermicast, or worm extracts, or compost. So you can make, I used to sell a certified organic humic acid that was from worm humicast. And so what you're looking at really is the fractions of an organic substance. So if you think soft brown coal, we're talking about 65 million year old dead dinosaurs, mm-hmm. plants, all of that stuff. Now, what's also in that material that just sort of takes it to the next level is it's full of what we call the quorum signals. So these are the biological metabolites from different types of bacteria and fungi. As they're breaking down stuff and they're communicating to each other, they're releasing these signals. So we take this product that's 65 million years old that still has these signaling proteins in it, and we mm-hmm. find plants respond to it really well. And it also has an impact in terms of the plant opens itself to it. So the research in humic acid shows that cell wall permeability, so how well something can enter a plant, increases by 30% with the addition of these humic acids. So mm-hmm. it means we can increase our efficacy of the products we're using, or the trace elements, or your nitrogen, by adding in some of these carbon sources. And the plants recognize it as food, and they recognize it as metabolites. And so we see massive increases in efficacy by adding them. And so generally I think of, as a general rule, fulvic for foliars and mm-hmm. humic for humus. So I'm using humic products on the soil, and fulvics as foliars. So if I'm doing trace elements or anything like that, I'm going to use a fulvic.
Mm-hmm. So you also said it works for when you're applying herbicides. And now obviously mm-hmm. we don't want to do that many of those, but you said that that will actually increase the efficacy of that too.
That's right. So, you know, I'd say the average size of operation that we work with is probably about 10,000 acres. Mm-hmm. And so many of them are using a lot of herbicides, and it becomes one tool where we can go, well, at least in year 1 to 3, we can be decreasing our use of herbicides by 30%. So that's mm-hmm. something that saves them money. It helps by the biology. We'll actually get in there and feed on then that herbicide. So we're testing soils and not seeing it showing up in the soil, not seeing it showing up in the plant. So there's some really interesting dynamics when we add those humic acids. Now, mm-hmm. I don't want it to be a license to be like, woohoo, well, we could just use all the chemicals we want. But certainly in transition, and what we find is as we start to build soil health, we need less and less and less of those chemicals. So guys are down to probably dropping that rate down to 70% in terms of the amount of herbicide that they're applying. So for me, that's an awesome, mm-hmm. an awesome start.
It's a step in the right direction.
It is, you know, like if you think about a lot of the techniques that are being put forth as other options, you know, to crimp a crop or do something like that, it's just not viable if you have 45,000 acres, you mm-hmm. know, and like, how are you going to do, you know, wheat and, yeah, and all those other crops like that. And I guess people could argue, well, that's industrial agriculture and we don't want that to happen at all. But while we're dealing with reality, mm-hmm. how do we help?
Yeah.
People still need to eat, but you know, how do we do that on a large scale? And that's always been my fascination. You know, it's working with the large scale operators in terms of how do we get the chemicals out of the system?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That fascinates me. Just the massive scale.
Yeah.
So something also you talk about too, and I don't think you could directly address it, but the hydroponic movement, mm-hmm. which I think also has deep connections to what I call the shallow, well, everyone calls the shallow organics.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
yeah, I'm a soil person. So yeah, hydroponics has never been my cup of tea. I don't believe that we can get the same nutrient density and the same quality from hydroponics without having your microbial partners. And, you know, people are in hydroponics putting in some of these biological additives, but they might be putting in like 6 species or something compared to, you know, millions of species, mm-hmm. billions of species. And you think, well, that biology is providing materials that we don't even fully understand yet, you know, the secondary metabolites, the vitamins, the enzymes, the hormones mm-hmm. that are what gives us life-giving food, you know. And I think the whole argument of, you know, we need these big stacked indoor energy inefficient systems to grow food for the planet. I think this COVID has really revealed how we don't have a food production issue, we have a food distribution issue. We don't need to all be growing indoors. And the fact that here in America you can be hydroponic and organic,
it's mind-blowing.
it's absolutely mind-blowing, and it just shows really good lobbying by the hydroponic people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think most organic standards have soil as the foundation of what they're doing, so I really can't understand how you can be hydroponic and organic. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it is that shallow organic as opposed to deep regenerative organic thinking.
Mm-hmm. Of the soil first.
Soil first.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about prospect farms. And you talk about how they're able to farm in such a brittle environment and produce way more than neighboring farms. What were the steps that they took to success?
Yeah. So Prospect Farm is in Western Australia, Di and Ian Haggerty. I think they are up to 45,000 acres now that they are managing, and they're growing, you know, just your small grain crops. Very brittle environment. So yeah, typically, I think the average rainfall might be 8 inches, but I don't think they've had an average rainfall for quite a while.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that they're producing way more than neighboring farms. They probably produce equivalent. But okay. What they see is when there's a lot of stress or they're having frost events, that they are not hit in the same way that the neighbors are, that they have a resilience system mm-hmm. so that they can produce even in a really poor year. They're still growing a crop. They are pretty ruthless in their approach in terms of what they do. They just pull the plug. They just, you know, they're taking on a lot of degraded, chemically melt, just abused land, and their whole program is orientated around these quorum signals. So using worm extracts and compost extracts, and that's it. No fungicides, no pesticides, minimal herbicides. So they still are using some. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You know, they're not using trace elements and using any minerals. And so the plants kind of do it hard for the first couple of years as they go from having a system that was pretty high input to nil inputs. But they've been doing that for, when did they start? I can't think. It might be around 15 years. I should know that. Anyway, yeah, so because they've got such a large area that they're managing, they can prop up those new blocks as they come in, because within, you know, 3 years, they are now back in the program and they've got, a biological system that's functioning very well. And really out there, it's biology that was missing. So in terms of their five M's, where to look, it's getting biological stimulants out there. And there's a lot of mineral, especially in these brittle environments. There's actually a lot of mineral that's just sitting there, that's just been sitting there forever, that's just not been plant available.
So once you get that biology working, even though it's a very brittle environment, it's just being able to uptake those nutrients that were sitting there waiting to be utilized.
And so they're measuring, you know, like their grain is a lot heavier, they have no residue, so there's no chemicals in their food. The digestibility of their grain is improved. Apparently it's great grain for making bread and all the rest of it. And I suspect people that have, wheat intolerances potentially could eat grain like that, because it's not full of, you know, herbicides and desiccants and all the rest of it. So I think that they're doing a fascinating job. So that's Prospect Farm. It's really worth looking up. They're Soils for Life, which is a big Australian project, has done quite a bit of work on them. And you can just Google them and have a look at what they're doing, because it's impressive.
Yeah, and you talk about them in the book too. What chapter again are they mentioned in the book?
Chapter 6, Let There Be Light, I think.
Yes. All right. So make sure you grab the book, check it out.
Yeah.
With that, I'd like to stop here and take a quick break. In a minute, we'll be back with Nicole. If you've been enjoying this episode so far, you're going to want to head over to growingfarmers.com/free resources and download our free resource bundle to help you shave hours off your week and become a thriving farmer. It includes resources such as our 10 winter growing secrets we wish we knew when we started, which is a ebook which talks about the tips and techniques to get better growth in your winter production. We teach things like the simple but counterintuitive principle that trips up most beginning growers, the shape and size of tunnels that are best for winter production, how to prepare beds so they are weed-free and get beautiful, lush stands of crops, what to do about pests like aphids, voles, and slugs, how to fast-track your research to fine-tune your production for your microclimate, and how to pack in more crops for higher yields and profits. So head over to growingfarmers.com/free resources and download your free resource bundle today. All right, guys, we are back with Nicole Masters. And Nicole, let's, you know, use actually some current stuff that I'm working on right now. Use myself as an example. So we're currently looking at a property that's had conventional corn on it and soy for the last 60 plus years. So right now it's just corn stubble. What would you, if you were to try to bring it back into production, what would be the fastest way to do so?
I would first of all want to just do a little bit of benchmarking and look at what is the situation that you're dealing with. So, you know, do your soil mineral test, and also do some multi-residue testing. It can be amazing what chemicals can be stuck in there, especially if people have been no-till for a long time, as we see a huge amount of buildup. And if we talked about the value of those humic substances, I wouldn't come into a program like that without using those humic substances, because we've seen a lot of chemical being flushed that might be, you know, used, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. We've seen atrazine coming through into crops that's just sitting there. So I'd want to get some testing done like that, or just at least know. I certainly think a reboot with diversity, if this is just typical soy, corn, you know, and bringing in livestock and just bringing in life, really, you know, so animals
Yeah. So if you can't bring in animals onto the property, would you then just try to bring in like a different mycorrhizae mix or just a bacterial mix and just like drip that on with some of the humic acid?
I probably use worm extracts. So I'm not second guessing what kind of biology. So yeah, the worm extracts is kind of my go-to place because there's so much diversity in that. But, you know, I think every property could have livestock. Maybe it needs ducks.
Yes. You know,
guinea pigs.
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Not that Americans eat guinea pigs, but
I don't know why not, but
yeah, they look so tasty. No.
The other thing you recommend too is that, you know, deep ripping to kind of break up the compaction. But one thing you mentioned is always be dribbling down some acids while you're doing that in the furrows.
Yeah, so well, humic acids or biological foods. So anytime you're out there with any kind of equipment, you need to be thinking, how do I feed my underground livestock? If I'm going, and I wouldn't recommend ripping unless you really had a major plow pan or hard pan that is a, and I've even seen with this with cover crops where they just won't break through those pans at all. And so maybe it's a once-off thing that you do, but while you're doing that, you're going to drip just a small amount of, so it could be a bit of molasses and a bit of humic acid, a bit of seaweed or something like that. And when I talk a bit, I'm talking like 1 or 2 pints. So we're talking tiny amounts per acre, just to start encouraging the roots and the biology to get down there. Otherwise, what people find is they mechanically open up a soil and then it just closes again. So we need to really encourage life to get down there.
Then would you come in with like a multi-species cover crop to kind of just start to build that life as well?
So probably like an annual multi-species in the first year, and then the depends, you know, if you're going to go into vegetable production, then you might just want a couple of annuals. I love sunflowers. I'm so excited about what sunflowers do.
So last year we had a couple acres we brought in and we did sunflowers on them. And one, obviously the entire town came out to see them and take pictures, which was awesome. But two, it just, you know, the soil life was just amazing. And we did cowpeas underneath them. And by the end, the cowpeas were just winding their way right up the sunflower stalks.
Oh, so cool. Another one that I've always seen and I've always grown in the garden is Phacelia. I don't know if you've played with Phacelia, but I mean,
I don't think we had enough per acre because I found some, but I needed to get more poundage per acre in there to really get it coming up.
Yeah. So I've been on operations that are actually feeding lambs on it. And I'd always just thought of it as a pollinator species, but you know, it does some pretty neat stuff in terms of mycorrhizae, and it's got pretty cool rooting systems, and and it's just so pretty. So I'm newly excited about Phacelia.
Very cool. I'll make sure to add that in. So another thing, I just got another soil test back that had super high mag, so like 25%, but my sulfur and my calcium were, my sulfur was already over what it should be, and my calcium was at the right level. Would you just keep adding more calcium?
Would I keep adding more calcium?
To try to push the magnesium back down.
Calcium by itself isn't necessarily going to push your mag right down. I mean, that's sulfur itself will off gas too. I mean, one of the things I like is to actually just put like a prill gypsum down the drill, and then you're not putting a lot on, so you're not going to really whack off your whack up the sulfur if the sulfur is really high. But we're talking like 30, 40 pounds an acre down the drill will actually help to open up and flocculate. And because a lot of these high mag soils are often big cationic, you know, big, they're big cation exchange soils. So that means they're like big clay, heavier soils often have a lot of mag in them. And so to try and address that, magnesium becomes cost prohibitive. And so by actually just putting a tiny bit down the drill, we find that we can then just influence that plant zone. So then that plant itself can work away and change and open up that soil. And I'll be looking at plant tissue tests as well. Like I don't look at soils in isolation because just because you're saying sulfur's high and high mag, and then you look at the plant tissue test and you'll find probably magnesium's low in the plant and sulfur might even be low. And so I don't just look at it in isolation, But yeah, you got to go, well, is that magnesium causing those soils to be really tight and sticky or hard? Because that's what high magnesium will do.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would get into that prill gypsum. And there is a liquid gypsum.
Okay.
Which is kind of neat to use. And you don't need a lot of that. I think you use like 1/2 gallon.
Okay. Yeah. That's not much at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would be probably a cheaper way to, a lot cheaper. Yeah.
Yeah. But the focus really is on not trying to make the perfect numbers and not trying to influence the whole system, but how do I support the plant so that it can do its job? So if I'm drilling something, how do I just enable that plant to get the best start and really take off? And then it will be the one that changes the numbers in the soil. It will be the one that actually changes what's happening with magnesium and all the rest of it. So that's kind of our focus, is more on that. How do you support the plant?
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Very cool.
Yeah.
We mentioned this a bit earlier, but water and infiltration, that is also incredibly important too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Especially in the crazy weather we've had in the last, I think it's more increasing every single year, it feels like.
It is. We are seeing more extreme events. You're going to get heavier rainfall and then dry periods. So having soils that infiltrate water is essential. And most people are absolutely shocked when they do an infiltration test. So they're really easy to do. All you need is like a piece of 6-inch PVC pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Make it like, 4 inches long, 6 inches wide, bang it in the ground and pour in 1 inch of water and time it, and then pour in 2 inches of water and time it. And if you've got the patience, see how much water your soil absorbs in 1 hour. Mm. And what we're finding on a lot of properties is they're not even absorbing 1 inch in 1 hour, which is really concerning. It's really concerning. And so some of these soils are hydrophobic, which literally means they're afraid of water, which is like, okay, now you've got some problems if your soil's afraid of water.
Yeah.
But some of the ranches or operations I work on, they're infiltrating 18 to 20 inches of water in 1 hour. And then you go, why are we concerned that we've got these flash floods? Because you've had 6 inches of rain. Mm-hmm. You should be able to absorb that.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't, because we have these water repellent soils that are tight or, whatever. And so people need to get really curious about what's happening with water. Are you part of the solution or part of the problem? And I talk about Twin Rivers in the book, which is just this remarkable Hutterite colony that I work with. And they just had a sort of 5.5 inch rainfall event overnight. And we drove around the district, and their property's like 27 kilometers long, so like 20 miles long.
Wow.
And everywhere we went, their drains are dry, and all the neighbors were flooding and running fast, and all their drains were dry. And we could walk out in their fields, and you could dig a hole, and you walk into the neighbors, and you're walking into mud and sitting water, and just, like the difference was so striking and so exciting. And those ranchers are like, they're really getting, if you can get water in the system, we now got a resilience instead of having all this water rushing off, and then it takes sediment with it. And then it's going to go down to, Chesapeake Bay or the Mississippi and just cause chaos.
Yeah. I mean, we're on the Miami River here, and that feeds into the Ohio, which is basically into the Mississippi.
Yeah.
And it's, every single rain we walk out and look at the river, and it's flooding our valley a bit. And it just dirty, dirty brown. And I just can't fathom the amount of soil that's just leaving our state.
No, I was just in Iowa recently doing a talk, and they were calculating some of those fields are losing 100 tons of topsoil per acre per year.
Oh my gosh.
When we talk about shivers, it's like, what are you doing? So, you know, America's biggest export continues to be soil. You guys are losing just billions of tons of soil, and it's an absolute travesty. And it doesn't need to happen.
So this Hutterite ranch, was that just pasture, or were they also doing crops?
So yeah, they're about 23,000 acres of crops, and then about 8,000 acres of cattle.
Very pasture. Interesting. And then like a no-till system, or?
Yep, no-till. Doing a range of small grains, and they were doing some canola and and doing about 1,000 acres a year of cover crop as well. So
okay.
Putting the cover crops in. And having some, you know, some great successes and some mixed successes when they weren't getting the rainfall for cover crops. And so it was really interesting to see, you know, like if you're in a low rainfall zone, cover crops might not be the answer for you. And a lot of people are reaching to the cover crop like a silver bullet. And it's like, well, you know, is it going to go well? I was just talking to a guy in the bottom of Colorado who their cover crops failed because they got too wet, you know, and it's like he's just a little small vegetable grower and he spent $1,000, you know, putting in this cover crop that then didn't grow. And it's like,
yeah,
we can't treat this stuff like a silver bullet. And that's where I would put other things down the drill so that at least something's going to be helping you work towards your goals.
So CEC, that's something I think a lot of people see in a soil test and aren't quite sure how to deal with. Talk about a little bit about the importance of that.
Yeah, so your cation exchange capacity is a measurement of your bank account in your soil, basically. Like, what size bank account do you have? Do you have this huge big bank vault, which might be a CEC of over 30, or do you have like a teeny tiny little piggy bank, which might be a CEC of below 5? And so below 5 would be telling you you've got a pure sand, pretty much.
Yeah.
I've actually got a client in Australia who's got a CEC of 0.
Oh my God.
and you're not allowed to call it sand. They call it a silver loam. I'm like, no, it's white beach sand. Anyway. Yeah, so CEC is a little bit like what your mama gave you when you take on a property. You know, is it something that is very heavy, does have a lot of clay? What will also increase the CEC or the ability to hold onto nutrients and water is having more carbon, so more organic matter. So if you have like a very sandy soil, you know, all gardeners know this, that we can increase that water holding and nutrient holding capacity through organic matter or compost or whatever. But again, this is part of, you know, we're talking about the plants pumping these exudates. That will really help to shift that CEC if you have a low one. Yeah, so carbon's kind of the elixir for a lot of things. You know, will actually help a heavy soil as well in terms of opening it up and flocculating, getting it to breathe.
Do you see people using biochar? Because I hear mixed results on that.
Well, the thing with biochar is that biochar can be made from so many different things and could be charged up with a whole lot of different types of biologicals. So you are going to get a range of results. I heard of an operation that was making biochar from tires.
Oh my gosh.
I know. So you want to be really careful about, you know, I think it's a lot like the municipal compost production. Who are they making that product for? Are they making a biochar for energy generation with a waste product that might not actually be suitable for agriculture? So you just got to be really careful about it and just, you know, ask those questions and then make sure you are mixing it with something like compost. Yeah, just because it's very, very acidic. Won't have a living component and it can be hydrophobic.
It's important to get life with it is what you're saying.
And the people that are doing biochar for agriculture should be providing that, but they're not necessarily.
Let's talk a little bit about worms. You talked at the beginning how you did some production yourself. Do you think that most farms should have a worm production like in theirs, or just, you know, picking up the vermicastings or the acids from people that are doing that?
I think unless you're in a semi-arid environment, you should have worms. Like, and you know, we come across this question when I'm working up in Canada because a lot of Canadian worms become extinct with the glaciation. You know, and the glaciers have retreated, but the worms haven't necessarily followed it. So some people think of the worms up there as a pest. But it's more that we're seeing ecological dynamics change, and humans don't like seeing stuff change unless they did it. So we're seeing these invasive worms, which are changing forest dynamics. And, you know, it's just part of what's going to happen with nature, because worms are going to move back into those environments over time. It's just been slower.
So you're saying those worms aren't necessarily a bad thing. They're just different.
They're just different. And so some of them are different species. I mean, a lot of what we see actually are European worms. It's quite funny. And so, they are changing. They will change forest dynamics because some of them are eating seeds. They're eating the leaf duff and stuff under the forest. So we will see actual forest. The forests at the moment everywhere globally are going through some pretty big changes. So I don't think it's just worms. There's a lot of stress in trees because we've lost, if you think potentially we've lost 75% of insects, maybe. I mean, that's debatable, but we've also lost birds and bears and fish and like all of that nutrient cycling that would happen in a natural environment is stopped. So we're seeing a lot of forest ecosystems under a lot of stress because they don't have the phosphate deposits that they used to get from all the guano, or you think of like bears. I mean, bears actually do poop in the woods.
Yes.
You know, they're bringing up all that salmon and the oils and all that loveliness for trees. And in New Zealand, like, it's really dramatic because we had so many seabirds and burrowing birds that are all extinct. And so we're seeing forest ecosystems collapse. But something new will come through. I mean, and I think because we see everything in our short little human lifespans, we panic and we get depressed about it or whatever. It's, I mean, you see the pine beetle, what's happening with that. And I've ridden through some of those places and it's quite horrifying. But it's just, you know, forests will reach a new equilibrium and species that can do well with low nutrient inputs will start to come through. You know, and I think the people freaking out about worms and stuff is just part of that cycle, is just the new normal and the new natives. I mean, and everywhere humans have gone, we've always disrupted ecosystems and brought new things with us.
Well, I think back to like the passenger pigeon. I mean, you hear the stories about that and just think about the incredible amount of nutrients that they were cycling.
Yeah. I think all that nitrogen, all that phosphorus, just, billions of tons, that's no longer happening anymore. So that's why you really want to look at your system and go, how do I get more diversity in here? How do I create a haven for birds and insects and all of it? Because they are bringing you nutrients. And, you know, like insects themselves are the nitrogen thieves in an environment. And I talk about it in the book in terms of, you know, a plant might have 4% nitrogen, but an insect has 16%. And they die in your environment. And so in forest ecosystems, insects and their poop and their dead bodies contribute 90% of the nitrogen that you see in the forest, which is just mind-boggling. And you think, well, if I've got all these pollinator plants and if I've got spiders just going crazy and I have all of this life, the amount of nutrient cycling that's happening is phenomenal.
You have a whole chapter on weeds, and I don't think we have time to get into it today, but let's talk about the Canadian thistle, because I know that's a weed that gets a very bad rap all the time, but it's not as bad as we think, I think, most of the time.
Well, again, it's an indicator, and it's telling you something about that ecosystem. And this is why it's important to dig up the roots of your weeds and have a look at what is that trying to do? You know, and Canadian thistle, you know, has a rhizomonous growth. It, has deep penetrating roots as well as horizontal roots. And you'll find that those horizontal roots will chase layers of compaction. So where you have tight zones, go and have a look and you'll see those roots follow that tight zone. And what it's trying to do is trying to flocculate and open up a soil. And there's actually an anaerobic bacteria that it has a relationship with. So it will only do well if it has these anaerobic pockets. So if you create that compaction and those tight zones and anaerobic pockets, you know, the thistles are going to go, oh, thank you very much. And so all weeds are responding to some kind of germination signal. And so in the book, I talk about the six factors that will lead to the signaling for a weed to germinate. So it's not just that there's a weed seed bank in there and you're automatically going to have these plants growing. It's that they received a signal. So for the thistles, they get a bacterial signal, an anaerobic signal to germinate. And so, yeah, if we start seeing them encroaching, you want to get really interested about what's happening. They're also telling you something about calcium, potentially high potassium. Yeah, so I'm not really too concerned about I mean I'm not concerned about weeds at all. I get really excited about them, but
yeah, and that field has high potassium, so that's one of the reasons right there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it could be a mineral issue, could be a microbial issue, could be that tight compacted problem.
Yeah. Let's talk a little about new farmers. I know you work with a lot of existing large farmers, but what do you think the biggest mistake beginning farmers make is?
Being a little gung-ho, I think, you know, and getting excited about something and leaping in all boots without, you know, it takes time to get to know your land. And I think sometimes just being with land and starting to observe, you know, what is that prevailing wind? When do I have these frosts? What are these conditions? This soil gets really wet now or whatever, because, you know, I see people planting plants that are not the right plants for that environment. So I think probably one of the best things a beginning farmer can do is find a mentor, find someone in their local area. And a lot of people are really happy to help newbies. And just, you know, take their advice and know that, yeah, you want to be, you know, you want to do everything, you know, and you want to do chickens and pigs and guinea pigs. And you'll work out there's probably some of those things you're very good at and some you're not so good at. And I think it's important not to have any animal welfare in your learning processes. But I think it is just that leaping in and maybe spending a lot of money on infrastructure when maybe it would be helpful to have another set of eyes. And even, you know, you might not find locals who are regenerative or doing permaculture or whatever you're interested in. So trying to find someone that's relatively nearby or can give you some good advice. And I think for me, when I set up the worm farm business, I just had someone who came out and spent a day with me and gave me the best advice possible. Uh-huh. So I just never had any problems and I've worked with, you know, household worm bin systems and seen how people can just really screw things up. And I'm never had to learn the hard way because I went and found someone who'd already done all that learning and I could just go, okay, I'm going to walk in their footsteps until I figure out my own system. I think there is a tendency to get really excited like you do, especially if you've wanted land your whole life and now you have it and you're like, yay, I'm going to, you know, farm llamas or something. And, yeah, then figure out actually you don't like them.
Yeah. No, I think that's, you know, what you said right there was incredible. You know, we're thinking of a new enterprise and, you know, one of the first things I'm working on right now is finding the top people in the country that are doing that.
Yeah.
Because I want to go pay them for a day and it's going to be probably a pretty big check.
Yeah.
But I'm going to walk away being so much further down the road
than
I would after 5 years of experimenting.
That's right. And it would have cost you more in that 5 year of experimenting. You know, I think that is the best investment you can make more than anything else. Yeah. Nice one. Yeah.
Let's talk. You mentioned, this is another thing which I love to talk about, is you mentioned Farmer C in your book. you talk about mindset. So share with us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I find, you know, people are concerned, you know, they've got these animal health issues or they've got these weed issues. And generally what it comes back to is if you're not sure where to look, look at yourself first, you know, and that can be the biggest and hardest thing for people to do. But mindset really is often the biggest limiting drag. And so I talk about this Farmer C because, he was the most infuriating guy I've ever had to work with. And I spent the day with him and he'd been trying regenerative biological approach for 10 years. And he was like, well, that doesn't work. And I'm like, have you tried this? Oh no, I've done that. That doesn't work. And this didn't work. And that didn't work. And we went outside at about lunchtime and I said, okay, can you take me to where you've been doing these practices in the same place for 3 years? Oh, I've never done that. Oh, okay. All right. So what were you looking to tell whether or not something was working? And all he was measuring was yield. And I'm like, okay, well, yield, if you're not going to keep it up in the same place, isn't really a measure for success. And so then finally, by the end of the day, he told me what his program was, which was a pre-emergent herbicide, a neonicotinoid fungicide seed treatment, a post-emergent herbicide, six fungicides, atrazine to burn off at the end of the season. And he was putting biologicals on the seed, and he's like, can I sell that as regenerative? And I'm like, no, you cannot. And so by the end of the day, he's like, so what do you think my limiting factor is? And I said to him, it's your attitude, mate. And then, yeah, I never worked with him again. But I've since heard and seen that actually he's doing a great job now. He actually needed someone to hold the mirror up and go, it's not the products, it's not this. He was so terrified of letting go of the side of the swimming pool, I guess you could say, like learning how to doggy paddle, that he wouldn't, his mindset was that he couldn't stop all those other inputs because he might get diseases or he might lose it to insects instead of, no, you've got to start swimming at some point and you've got to build your soil health so that you can actually swim. So you need to be doing things for longer than a couple of years. So having that flick and mindset has now positioned him to be one of the leaders in his region. I mean, he's selling seeds now and doing all sorts of really cool, innovative stuff. But he was being totally stopped by fear. And fear is very common in agriculture. And I think fear is certainly peddled a lot by, you know, the agronomists and, you know, chemical suppliers and stuff, is really keep people fearful so that they'll stay on the treadmill and buy the, you know, whatever you're peddling.
Yeah, that is incredibly sad.
Yeah.
If you could pick one, what would be your favorite farming tool?
A spade, shovel.
Okay. Yeah. To be able to get down there and see the livestock and the soil.
Yeah. And most people are not digging holes and not digging enough holes. You know, even before you buy a piece of land, go and dig some holes. Go and have a look at what you're about to buy. It's your biggest investment and most people have no idea. They could be sitting on top of something really bad. But I think using observations, like all of them, like smell and touch and even taste and like just really looking for what are those signs for health and vibrancy. And so, yeah, your shovel's going to be your number one tool. And most people have never used it for anything except to dig holes for putting in a fence. Yeah.
You know, at the end of the book, you talk about how the future is now. Talk a little bit about that. Do you feel like now is the best time to be farming?
I think with COVID, actually, it is, because people are getting really interested about where their food's coming from and getting really interested in, I mean, all of my buddies that are doing CSAs and direct marketed beef and lamb, and their sales are just going through the roof because people are getting really interested about where your food's coming from. And meanwhile, we're seeing, you know, industrial agriculture really struggle because they can't get to market, seeing all the food that's being dumped and all the milk that's being dumped. So I think actually people with the knowledge and experience that can teach others to farm as well, I think we're getting back to that grassroots. And I think for me, that's one of the positive outcomes that's going to come out of all of this. But yeah, I think people hold like hope out in some kind of future space instead of actually things are happening around us now and are happening really, really quickly. So for me, it is about what is happening now and seeing people's ability to be incredibly profitable and not need the massive tracts of land because they have diverse enterprises. You know, they might be doing honey and puppies and mushrooms and, you know, whatever lights your fire, but, you know, getting clever about diversity. I talked about a friend of mine in the book who has a cordyceps mushroom that's, people are familiar with cordyceps. They are entomopathogenic. So ento meaning insect, pathogen meaning disease, or actually the Greek for it means literally suffering. So insect suffering, and it's a fungus that invades into insects, takes over their bodies, and then grows these big mushroom bodies out of them. Well, the actual mushroom has been used by the Chinese for thousands of years for endurance and stamina and virility. Yeah, apparently it does work very well. And so he's found them growing all around his place. And it's like, it actually has the potential to make more money for him than all his cattle. you know, cool. And so sometimes I just think we've got to be thinking outside the box, and you know, these huge tracts of land and all that people run is cattle, and it's like, mm-hmm. well, what else could you do just to build resilience into your operations? So, you know, even if it's selling seeds or whatever, but I do think now is one of the best times. I don't know. Actually, that's not true. I don't know if it's one of the best times, because we are going to see more volatility in terms of climate. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the best time for us to be focusing on soil and mm-hmm. soil health, because we are not going to be able to continue to produce food the way we have been into an uncertain future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the chemical age or the green revolution is coming to a close.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. We're seeing massive growth. I mean, we're seeing, I'm getting texts because we obviously work with a lot of vegetable growers, and I know so many of them. And like one farm set up a co-op, and last week they did $100,000 through that co-op.
In 1 week?
In 1 week, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, he texted me the first week was 30, then it was 50, then it was 70, and then it was 100.
Yeah, bring so it on.
It is unbelievable. And yeah, it's the farmers who are set up to be year round that are really being able to crush it right now.
Yeah.
But I believe this summer too. I mean, I think there will be an overarching wave. And one of the things I saw was, you know, all right, how are we going to keep these people? And I was like, yes, that is the question. Because if mm-hmm. you don't help them establish and then keep those new habits, they're just going to go right back to Walmart.
That's right. But that's where I think we need to be producing top quality, nutrient dense mm-hmm. food, because you eat, like we used to grow kale that was running a Brix of 15. So Brix mm-hmm. is a measurement of photosynthesis. Most kale that you buy at the grocery store runs between 1 to 3, and it tastes bitter, and it just tastes like crap, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You produce kale of the Brix of 15. It is sweet and flavorful, and you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know kale could be like this.
Yes.
If you could provide food like that to people, they're not going to go back to the McDonald's style, low nutrient dense. Like, why mm-hmm. would you? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, providing excellent customer service, making it easy for them so that they're not having to go round and round and round. And I think some of the depots with the CSAs and, you know, just trying to make it a bit easier for people, because that is the attraction of Walmart, obviously.
Well, yes. Yes. Is that you get exactly what you want and you get it quickly. And so I think the old style CSA where you just get a box every single week, I think the millennial culture is not going to, there's only a very small portion of those, the hipster people, which are okay with that. Yes. Me and my wife. Yeah. We could totally deal with that because our background is that, and we just love vegetables, but people, they want to pick what they're going to eat. A kohlrabi is scary to them.
Yeah.
So yeah, being able to have that convenience and what they want is going to be so important. You know, it's interesting you brought up kale, because just the other day, I had my little 3-year-old Simon out, and he actually went to the kale patch. He picked himself a leaf and stuffed it in his mouth and was eating it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's mind blowing that you gotta, you know, because that normally would be so bitter that they'd just be spitting it out and like, oh, this is nasty. Yeah. I'll have to send you that picture. It's kind of cute.
Yeah, send me the picture. Yeah, my son used to do that. I'd watch him walk to the school bus and grab kale, and I'd be like, that is not normal. But yeah, how we can just delight the senses with something like that. And I think, you know, seeing the emergence, I guess, of some of these food bags where they are providing like all the ingredients and they give you their menu and whatever. I mean, you could provide a kohlrabi and with the, you know, this is how you cook it, and this is mm-hmm. what it's like. And I think most people, like, Jerusalem artichokes, and then the other artichokes.
Globe artichoke.
Globe artichokes. You know, that is an eating experience, but mm-hmm. most people would not know how to deal with that at all. And it's being able to make it easy and make it fun and tasty.
Providing those recipes.
Yeah. And then there's no going back. I mean, I love Jerusalem artichokes. I put them everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually had a pizza that had Jerusalem artichokes shaved and then like deep fried on top of the pizza. It was incredible.
Yeah, that would be good. That would be good. Yeah. Yeah.
So where can people find out more about you and your work?
So Integrity Soils, the website, we have information on that. And then, I do seem to get around a bit. So there's quite a lot of YouTube videos and stuff. Yeah. I've got an older TED talk that's out there on, you know, falling in love with soil. And yeah, I really recommend people grab a copy of my book. It is available on Kindle as well as a hard copy, and there is Audible as well. So
that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I find a lot of farmers and growers are listening to Audible these days. And it's in my New Zealand accent, so you'll be fluent by the end of it.
Well, Nicole, we really appreciate you spending the time with us tonight. I know that you interrupted your day to come on, so we appreciate that. And we wish you the best. And again, I really enjoyed the book. It was part of my 6 a.m. reading schedule for about 2 weeks. So
I can't believe you said not another soil book. So I'm really, really, really pleased that you enjoyed it.
Well, it's one of those things. Every single soil book I read, I get a little bit more out of. But then again, it's becoming such a big part of my library.
Yes.
Because it's so important. So no, it's good stuff. And absolutely. I still feel like a baby in the whole, interpreting soil tests, but
You keep on learning,
All right. Well, Nicole, we'll let you go, but thanks again so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the chat. I really enjoyed it. All right. All the best, Michael.
Thank you. Hey, thriving farmers. Next week, Dan Miller, who is the founder and CEO of Steward, the world's first crowd farming platform, will be joining me. So Steward enables people to invest directly in sustainable farms through them, managing the investment, or through farmers just creating a profile and actually building a crowdfunding platform there as well. So super interesting and fascinating interview. They've been around for a couple years now, so they've actually had some track record, and we talked about that. And we just talked about Dan's philosophy on farm investments and how you should start funding your farm. So again, join me next week and listen to Dan talk all about funding your farm. So there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.